protection against alcoholism. Speaking in 1853, she explained some of her views.
It has been objected to our society that we do not confine ourselves to the subject of temperance, but talk too much about women's rights, divorce, and the church. We have been obliged to preach women's rights because many, instead of listening to what we had to say on temperance, have questioned the right of a woman to speak on any subject. Let it be clearly understood, then, that we are a women's rights society, that we believe it is woman's duty to speak whenever she feels the impression to do so, that it is her right to be present in all the councils of church and state. Again, in discussing the question of temperance, all lecturers from the beginning have made mention of the drunkard's wives and children, of widows' groans and orphans' tears. Shall these classes of sufferers be introduced but as themes for rhetorical, as pathetic touches of the speaker's eloquence? Shall we passively shed tears over their condition, or by giving them their rights, bravely open to them the doors of escape from a wretched and degraded life? Is it not legitimate in this to discuss the social degradation, the legal disabilities of the drunkard's wife? If in showing her wrongs we prove the right of all womankind to the elective franchise, to a fair representation in the government, to the right in criminal cases to be tried by peers of her own choosing, shall it be said that we transcend the bounds of our subject? If in pointing out her social degradation, we show you how the present laws outrage the sacredness of the marriage institution. If in proving to you that justice and mercy demand a legal separation from drunkards, we grasp the higher idea that a unity of soul alone constitutes and sanctifies true marriage, and that any law or public sentiment that forces two immortal, high-born souls to live together as husband and wife, unless held there by love, is false to God and to humanity. Who shall say that the discussion of this question does not lead us legitimately into the consideration of the important subject of divorce?
Emma Hart Willard, 1787 to 1870, was a noted educator who established the first United States college-level institution for women, the Troy Female Seminary. In 1819, she sent an address proposing a plan for improving female education to Governor DeWitt Clinton of New York. This document has been called the Magna Carta of Higher Education for American Women. The object of this address is to convince the public that a reform with respect to female education is necessary, that it cannot be effected by individual exertion, but that it requires the aid of the legislature, and further, by showing the justice, the policy, and the magnanimity of such an undertaking, to persuade that body to endow a seminary for females as the commencement of such a reformation. The absurdity of sending ladies to a college may at first thought strike everyone to whom this subject shall be proposed. I therefore hasten to observe that the seminary here recommended will be as different from those appropriated to the other sex as the female character and duties are from the male. If the improvement of the American female character, and that alone could be effected by public liberality employed in giving better means of instruction, such improvement of one half of society, and that half which barbarous and despotic nations have ever degraded, would of itself be an object worthy of the more liberal government on earth. But if the female character be raised, it must inevitably raise that of the other sex, and thus does the plan proposed offer as the object of legislative bounty to elevate the whole character of the community. As evidence that this statement does not exaggerate the female influence in society, our sex need but be considered in the single relation of mothers. In this character, we have the charge of the whole mass of individuals who are to compose the succeeding generation during that period of youth when the pliant mind take any direction to which it is steadily guided by a forming hand. How important a power is given by this charge. Yet, little do too many of my sex know how either to appreciate or improve it. Would we rear the human plant to its perfection, we must first fertilize the soil which produces it. If it acquire its first bent and texture upon the barren plain, it will avail comparatively little should it be afterwards transplanted to a garden.
Paulina Wright Davis was chosen to preside over the first National Women's Rights Convention held in Worcester, Massachusetts in 1850. One of the core of women who worked with Stanton over the next 20 years or more, she opened the convention with an address describing the women's movement.
The reformation we propose in its utmost scope is radical and universal. It is not the mere perfecting of a reform already in motion, a detail of some established plan, but it is an epochal movement, the emancipation of a class, the redemption of half the world, and a conforming reorganization of all social, political, and industrial interests and institutions. Moreover, it is a movement without example among the enterprises of associated reformations, for it has no purpose of arming the oppressed against the oppressor, or of separating the parties, or of setting up independence, or of severing the relations of either. Its intended changes are to be wrought in the intimate texture of all societary organizations, without violence or any form of antagonism. It seeks to replace the worn out with the living and the beautiful, so as to reconstruct without overturning, and to regenerate without destroying. We claim for woman a full and generous investiture of all the blessings which the other sex has solely or by her aid achieved for itself. We appeal from man's injustice and selfishness to his principles.
The issue of women's rights quickly spread, and conventions, the main tool of the movement, were called in many cities and towns. Frances D. Gage, a leader in the early movement in Ohio, recalled a scene years later of the convention in 1851. A tall, gaunt black woman walked into the meeting, came to the head of the assembly, and sat listening to the speakers. The woman was Sojourner Truth, the only black woman to speak on the questions of women's rights in the earlier part of the movement. Her presence was not at first always appreciated. As Mrs. Gage recalled, in 1851, she was urged not to let Sojourner Truth speak.
Don't let her speak, Mrs. Gage. It will ruin us.
Every newspaper in the land will have our cause mixed up with abolition and niggers, and we shall be utterly denounced.
My only answer was, we shall see when the time comes. There were very few women in those days who dared to speak in meeting. And the august teachers of the people were seemingly getting the better of us, while the boys in the galleries and the sneerers among the pews were hugely enjoying the discomfiture, as they supposed, of the strong-minded. When slowly from her seat in the corner rose Sojourner Truth, who, till now, had scarcely lifted her head.
Don't let her speak!
She moved slowly and solemnly to the front and turned her great sparkling eyes to me. There was a hissing sound of disapprobation above and below. I rose and announced, Sojourner Truth, and begged the audience to keep silence for a few moments. Nearly 6 feet high, head erect, and eyes piercing the upper air, at her first word there was a profound hush.
Well, children, where there's so much racket, there must be something out of kilter. Now, I think that twixt the niggers of the South and the women of the North all talking about rights, the white man will be in a fix pretty soon. But what's all this here talking about? Now, that man over there said that women needs to be helped into carriages and lifted over ditches and have the best place everywhere. Nobody ever helps me in the carriages or over mud puddles or gives me any best place. And ain't I a woman? Look at me. Look at my arm. I have plowed and planted and gathered in the barns and no man could head me. And ain't I a woman? I could work as much and eat as much as a man when I could get it and barely lash as well. And ain't I a woman? I have borne 13 children and seen them most all sold off to slavery. And when I cried out my mother's grief, none but Jesus heard me. And ain't I a woman? And that little man in the black there, he say women can't have much rights as men because Christ wasn't a woman. Where did your Christ come from? Where did your Christ come from? From God and a woman. Man didn't have nothing to do with him. If the first woman God ever made was strong enough to turn the world upside down all alone, these women together ought to be able to turn it back and get it right side up again. And now they's asking to do it, and the men better let them. Obliged to you for hearing on me. Now, old surgeon ain't got nothing else more to say.
At the beginning, the strongest opposition to the women's rights movement was expressed by the clergy. Because of her experience as a minister in the Society of Friends, Lucretia Mott was often called upon to refute the men of the cloth. At a convention in 1854, she spoke in answer to a comment from a minister in the audience.
It is not Christianity, but priestcraft that has subjected woman as we find her. The church and state have been united, and it is well for us to see it so. We have had to bear the denunciations of these reverend, irreverend clergymen of late. But if we look to their authority to see how they expound the text, quite likely we shall find a new reading. Blame is often attached to the position in which woman is found. I blame her not so much as I pity her. So circumscribed have been her limits that she does not realize the misery of her condition. The veneration of man has been misdirected. The pulpit has been prostituted. The Bible has been ill-used. It has been turned over and over as in every reform. The temperance people have had to feel its supposed denunciations, then the anti-slavery, and now this reform has met and still continues to meet passage after passage of the Bible, never intended to be so used. Instead of taking the truths of the Bible in corroboration of the right, the practice has been to turn over its pages to find example and authority for the wrong, for the existing abuses of society. We have been so long pinning our faith on other people's sleeves that we ought to begin examining these things daily ourselves, to see whether they are so. And we should find, on comparing text with text, that a very different construction might be put upon them. I do not want to dwell too much upon scripture authority. We too often bind ourselves by authorities rather than by the truth.
Pioneers in the women's abolitionist movement were Sarah and Angelina Grimke, daughters of a South Carolina slaveholding family. Their early life left them with a loathing for slavery and a burning desire to participate in its abolition. They moved north and became frequent speakers at anti-slavery societies throughout the United States. Churches deeply opposed their work, for these two women had broken with the approved decorum for women of their century. In 1838, Sarah Grimke wrote a series of articles entitled The Equality of the Sexes and the Condition of Women.
Woman, I am aware, stands charged to the present day with having brought sin into the world. I shall not repel the charge by any counter-assertions, although Adam's ready acquiescence with his wife's proposal does not savor much of that superiority in strength of mind which is arrogated by man. All history attests that man has subjected woman to his will, used her as a means to promote his selfish gratification, to minister to his sensual pleasures, to be instrumental in promoting his comfort. But never has he desired to elevate her to that rank she was created to fill. He has done all he could to debase and enslave her mind, and now he looks triumphantly on the ruin he has wrought and says the being he has thus deeply injured is his inferior. I ask no favors for my sex. I surrender not our claim to equality. All I ask of our brethren is that they will take their feet from off our necks.
At a meeting of the Women's National Loyal League at Cooper Institute in New York in May of 1863, the following resolution was adopted. Resolved, there can never be a true peace in this republic until the civil and political rights of all citizens of African descent and all women are practically established. Angelina Grimke, Weld, spoke to this resolution.
I rejoice exceedingly that the resolution should combine us with the Negro. I feel that we have been with him, that the iron has entered into our souls. True, we have not felt the slaveholder's lash. True, we have not had our hands manacled. But our hearts have been crushed. Was there a single institution in this country that would throw open its door to the acknowledgement of woman's equality with man until 20 years ago? Have I not heard woman say, oh, brother, that I could go to college with you, that I could have the instruction you do, but I am crushed. I hear nothing, I know nothing, except in the fashionable circle. I was not made for embroidery and dancing. I was made a woman. But I cannot be a true woman, a full-grown woman in America. But woman is full-grown today, whether man knows it or not. Equal to her rights and equal to the responsibilities of the hour. I want to be identified with the Negro. Until he gets his rights, we never shall have ours.
Many early feminists allied themselves with the struggle to abolish slavery. Frances Watkins Harper, Negro anti-slavery lecturer and noted poet, speaks of the plight of the slave mother.
Heard you that shriek? It rose so wildly on the air. It seemed as if a burdened heart was breaking in despair. Saw you those hands so sadly clasp, the bowed and feeble head, the shuddering of that fragile form that looked of grief and dread? Saw you the sad, imploring eye? Its every glance was pained, as if a storm of agony was sweeping through the brain. She is a mother, pale with fear. Her boy clings to her side, and in her kirtle vainly tries his trembling form to hide. He is not hers, although she bore for him a mother's pains. He is not hers, although her blood is coursing through his veins. He is not hers, for cruel hands may rudely tear apart the only wreath of household love that binds her breaking heart. His love has been a joyous light that o'er her pathway smiled, a fountain gushing ever new amid life's desert wild. His lightest word has been a tone of music round her heart. Their lives a streamlet blent in one. Oh, father, must they part? They tear him from her circling arms, her last and fond embrace. Oh, nevermore may her sad eyes gaze on his mournful face. No marvel, then, these bitter shrieks disturb the listening air. She is a mother, and her heart is breaking in despair.
Margaret Fuller, the Marchese da Soli, 1810 to 1850, was a feminist, critic, and journalist. With Ralph Waldo Emerson and George Ripley, she edited the Transcendentalist journal, The Dial. From 1839 to 44, she conducted her conversations in Boston, drawing her pupils from leading circles of the city. The material of her conversations appeared in her feminist work, Woman in the 19th Century.
If you ask me what offices women may fill, I reply, any. I do not care what case you put. Let them be sea captains, if you will. I do not doubt there are women well fitted for such an office. And if so, I should be glad to see them in it. I think women need, especially at this juncture, a much greater range of occupation than they have, to rouse their latent powers. In families that I know, some little girls like to saw wood, others to use carpenter's tools. Where these tastes are indulged, cheerfulness and good humor are promoted. Where they are forbidden, because such things are not proper for girls, they grow sullen and mischievous. I have no doubt that a large proportion of women would give themselves to the same employments as now, because there are circumstances that must lead them. Mothers will delight to make the nest soft and warm. Nature would take care of that. No need to clip the wings of any bird that wants to soar and sing, or finds in itself the strength of pinion for a migratory flight unusual to its kind. The difference would be that all need not be constrained to employments for which some are unfit. I have urged upon the sex self-subsistence in its two forms of self-reliance and self-impulse, because I believe them to be the needed means of the present juncture. I have urged on woman independence of man. Not that I do not think the sexes mutually needed by one another, but because in women, this fact has led to an excessive devotion, which has cooled love, degraded marriage, and prevented either sex from being what it should be to itself or the other. I wish woman to live first for God's sake. Then she will not make an imperfect man her God and thus sink to idolatry. Then she will not take what is not fit for her from a sense of weakness and poverty. Then, if she finds what she needs in man embodied, she will know how to love and be worthy of being loved. By being more a soul, she will not be less woman, for nature is perfected through spirit. Now, there is no woman, only an overgrown child. That her hand may be given with dignity, she must be able to stand alone. Woman, self-centered, would never be absorbed by any relation. It would only be an experience to her as to man. It is a vulgar error that love, a love to woman, is her whole existence. She also is born for truth and love in their universal energy. It is not woman, but the law of right, the law of growth that speaks in us and demands the perfection of each being in its kind. Apple as apple, woman as woman. What concerns me now is that my life be a beautiful, powerful, in a word, a complete life in its kind. Had I but one more moment to live, I must wish the same.
Lucy Stone spent most of her adult life working for the rights of women. When she married, she refused to take her husband's name, preferring to be called Mrs. Stone. In 1855, she spoke.
The last speaker alluded to this movement as being that of a few disappointed women. From the first years to which my memory stretches, I have been a disappointed woman. When, with my brothers, I reached forth after the sources of knowledge, I was reproved with, it isn't fit for you, it doesn't belong to women. I was disappointed when I came to seek a profession worthy an immortal being. Every employment was closed to me, except those of the teacher, the seamstress, and the housekeeper. In education, in marriage, in religion, in everything, disappointment is the lot of woman. It shall be the business of my life to deepen this disappointment in every woman's heart until she bows down to it no longer. I wish that women, instead of being walking showcases, instead of begging of their fathers and brothers the latest and gayest new bonnet, would ask of them their rights. I am detaining you too long, many of you standing, that I ought to apologize. But women have been wrong so long that I may wrong you a little.
Elizabeth Blackwell became the first American woman doctor after many struggles against discrimination. Here she speaks of her years as a medical student.
In 1845, when I resolved to be a physician, six eminent physicians in different parts of the country were written to for advice. They all united in dissuading me, stating that it was an utter impossibility for a woman to obtain a medical education, that the idea, though good in itself, was eccentric and utopian, utterly impracticable. It was only by long-continued searching through all the colleges of the country that one was at last found willing to grant admission. When I entered college, in 1847, I had not the slightest idea of the commotion created by my appearance as a medical student. Very slowly, I perceived that a doctor's wife at the table avoided any communication with me, and that as I walked backwards and forwards to college, the lady stopped to stare at me as at a curious animal. I was considered a bad woman, whose designs would gradually become evident, or that being insane, an outbreak of insanity would soon be apparent. I hastened daily to my college as a sure refuge. I knew that when I shut the great doors behind me, that I shut out all the unkindly criticism, and I soon felt perfectly at home amongst my fellow students.
Dr. Blackwell came to New York City to establish her medical practice.
The first 7 years of New York life were years of very difficult, though steady uphill work. There was the utmost difficulty in finding a boarding house where the simple name physician could be placed. Ladies would not reside in a house so marked, and expressed the utmost astonishment that it should be allowed in a respectable establishment. I had no medical companionship. The profession stood aloof, and society was distrustful of the innovation. I presented American and foreign testimonials of medical qualification to one of the city dispensaries, asking permission as an assistant physician in the Department of Diseases of Women and Children. The request was refused. I asked permission to visit in the female wards of one of the city hospitals. The application was laid on the table, not being considered worthy of notice. There was a blank wall of social and professional antagonism that formed a situation of singular and painful loneliness. I understand now why this life has never been lived before. It is hard, with no support but a high purpose, to live against every species of social opposition. I should like a little fun now and then. Life was altogether too sober.
Anna Howard Shaw, 1847 to 1919, grew up in the backwoods of Michigan. The memories of pioneer hardships never left her. She became a preacher and then a physician. Her interest and activity in the Women's Christian Temperance Union was her introduction to the suffrage movement. She was one of its great orators. In 1904, she became the president of the National American Woman Suffrage Association. Dr. Shaw speaks of her work in her early careers as a preacher and then as a doctor.
When I started out in life, I made up my mind that I would become a missionary and would go to the women who, more than others, need friends and yet suffer the greatest abuses. So I studied theology and, when I graduated, Thinking I knew something about what I had undertaken, I attempted to help the homeless and the forsaken and the betrayed women of the community. In a little while, I found that I had nothing to give that they wanted. And I also found out that, although I knew something about theology, I knew very little about human beings. For I learned that it is useless to talk virtue to a starving girl. I looked around and found that I could do practically little. But, I thought, there is one woman who does do something, and that is a doctor. For a woman doctor can go to these women when they are sick and suffering, and minister to them, and bring them some sort of relief and comfort. So I went back to school and studied medicine and took my degree, and again went down into the byways to live and to work, and unceasingly try to do something to be helpful. At the end of 3 years, I gave up in utter despair. The same desperate problems that had faced all other workers in such lines faced me also. What is needed first of all for these poor girls is some rational satisfaction for their human nature. What they need is employment under conditions which shall not crush out and atrophy all their natural human demands. What is needed is a fair chance for each, a fair day's wage.